everybody doing tonight? Welcome to Two Beers In. This is a tipsy political roundtable. I usually host this show with my wife, Cody Lindquist. She is on assignment today at a Donald Trump Jr. rally. So, you know, feel sorry for her, I guess. But no, she's working with a TV news organization doing a piece at a Donald Trump Jr. rally. So hopefully that'll be something that we can share on TV sometime soon. So I'm on my own tonight. This is the show where we invite our comedian friends, our journalist friends, our policy expert friends to have a couple of beers and talk politics. We've been drinking in the bar. We've been drinking in the green room. There's a lot more wine than normal this week, and we'll see how that maybe changes the show. So let's bring our panel out. But actually, one thing I should say first, our next show will be on Monday, November 26th, right here at UCB Theater East. We do it every month here at the UCB Theater East, and we podcast this. We record these live shows, put them out on a podcast, so subscribe to our podcast and give us a rating and a review and all that stuff. Okay, Pat, let's bring out our guests. First, she is a journalist from Oath, also has been with Vice News Tonight and HuffPo. Please welcome Caroline Matarassi-Tirani. Next up is a comedian and writer for Late Night with Seth Meyers. Please welcome Ali Horde. And finally, very funny comedian and actor from GLOW and Mr. Robot, please welcome Sunita Mani. So a little bit later, we're going to bring out Gridlock Sam Schwartz to talk about traffic and transit, one of my pet issues. So we're really excited to have him here. So he'll be out in a little bit. But welcome, everybody. How are the red wines?
It's lovely.
They're great.
It's the best box wine I've ever had.
Warming.
We also, even though no one's drinking it at the moment, we want to thank Bronx Brewery, who provides free beer to the show, and to all of UCB Comedy's podcasts.
That's amazing.
They don't pay us, but they do give us some free beer. I want to check in with everybody about the midterms and see how everybody's feeling. I am terrified. I'm freaking out. It feels a lot like October 2016, where everybody's starting to check 538 again and starting to, you know, freak out, and I don't know. I have a queasy feeling about it. I don't know. What do you guys think? We're 15 days away.
I'm cautiously optimistic. I feel like we're gonna get the House. I mean, this is barring all the voter suppression, of course. I feel like we're gonna get the House, and hopefully that will give us some power and some check against, you know, the corruption within the Trump administration. And if we don't, then I feel like we'll be ready for the next step, which is like French Revolution, which I'm excited about.
Yeah, that we need.
Yeah.
That we need. God, I'm so scared. I'm scared. I don't know. I feel like hope is stupid, even though I have to have it and have to like just live in that. That's more useful. But I don't know. Just been crushed over and over and over. It's funny, like, just being aware, you know, talking to you about being on this show and, like, just, you know, being aware of the news. But I feel like I've also taken a conscious effort to, like, not be so in the news because it's so depressing. But, especially after, like, the Kavanaugh stuff, shit. So, yeah, I guess my answer is I'm scared, but I remain hopeful.
I feel like I have a low dose of lorazepam going, so I just I just don't really feel.
Is that an antidepressant?
It is. It's a great antidepressant. Okay. Yeah, it also helps with flight anxiety. I've just been kind of neutral, non-feeling.
Yeah.
Which has kind of been my MO of being able to kind of get through it. I don't know. I feel, am I as hopeful? I think that I am more nervous as we get closer, just because the rhetoric machine is kind of out in full force. Like, you know, every single day we get closer and every single time Trump doubles down into something like, there's a caravan of migrants, an army, you know, like it.
Did you hear the breaking news that there are Muslims inside the caravan?
I didn't.
This is not a joke. This is not a joke. Trump today said that there are some Muslims in the caravan.
Charlie, it's unknown Middle Easterners.
Sorry, not Muslims. He said unknown Middle Easterners are in the middle of the caravan. All of the Middle Easterners from Honduras are marching up through Guatemala, through Mexico, to the Texas border.
I like to think that Persians are everywhere, so we very well could be like Persian and Honduran. But yeah, I mean, it's just, it's stuff like that, right? Like the more that those drum beats kind of come out where they start talking about like, you know, ooh, spooky, you know, also not Guatemalan, but also ISIS. Yeah. I saw a black flag. Like, you know, it really does, you know, to the armchair voter, and those are the people who are like watching the propaganda networks out in force, they are the ones who are going to ultimately vote. And, you know, it is a little bit depressing just sort of reading a poll from the Times this morning about how there is now some sort of like lethargy. I think, I don't know if it's a post-Kavanaugh like dip we're seeing from people who are just, like you were saying, feeling
from Democrats?
Shitty.
Just people who are just like Democrats. Depressed?
Well, I think like early voting is already going on. And we saw, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw the headlines, like the turnout in Houston was insane. It looked like a Beto O'Rourke rally, and that was just the line to vote.
Is that because they got rid of all the polling places except for one?
That's also very fair. Yeah, I mean, listen, 2 weeks is a lot of runway for Trump to still kill us all. He pulled out of that nuclear treaty with Russia today.
Oh, right, yeah. We're
he's getting a lot done.
But did he actually pull out, or he just said he might?
He said he's going to, and the Russians are like, what are you doing? Even they're like, you're insane. Mikhail Gorbachev was like, this is not a decision of a sound mind. So,
but that's when the Putin's kind of like, but I respect him.
And that treaty is basically just like we're both agreeing that we're not going to make any more nukes.
Yeah, it's an anti-proliferation treaty. Okay. Yeah.
All right, so we're going to both make more nukes. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Kavanaugh a little bit, because I can't remember if that happened before or after our last show. I get the news, like, it's hard to tell.
It was like a month long of just bad news.
Yeah. And incredibly depressing. But the thing that's driven me crazy is that not only did he get on the Supreme Court, not only did nothing happen, not only did, as Dr. Ford said would happen, she like put herself in front of the train and nothing happened, also apparently it was good for Republicans and it's turning the tide. Like, can somebody explain that to me? How is the fact that like a sexual assaulter got on the Supreme Court good for them?
There was this line, I think Kellyanne Conway kind of said it, which is that Kavanaugh is like, everyone that she knows is brother or husband or, like, unfortunately, he's, like, the relatable sexual assaulter. You know, like, everyone has one, everyone knows one. Like, it's just, you know, that's the sad truth of the matter is that I think that...
But how is he relatable? He, like, cried like a baby and yelled for
half
hour.
You know what it was? What do you think all Republicans do?
Good point.
Lindsey Graham almost cried screaming in his defense. That's how they react.
Impassioned, Christian.
But fun adjectives men get to have.
But as the only man on this panel, I have to ask, like, don't you feel like every woman, no matter what party, would be radicalized on the other side based on what happened? Like, isn't it going to motivate all those terrible white women who voted for Trump to, like...
Well, actually, no, a poll did come out today that was, like, college-educated women are moving away from Trump. I don't know what that cross-section is with college-educated white women. They're still... You know,
the worst.
Yeah. I'm like, women hate themselves.
Like, yeah, is that what it is?
So many women hate themselves, and like people of color. Like, it's so deep; it goes so deep, and it's like re-engaging all these things that we've moved away from in certain lights. But just the administration is like pounding it back in that you're like you're all these things subconsciously that you've been like trying to fight against. Ugh. But I forgot.
Do you guys think that one day we'll find the Brett Kavanaugh lookalike who did that sexual assault? Do you think we're ever going to be able to find that person?
I mean, it'd be like the Khashoggi one in, you know, Turkey. Like, there are lookalikes everywhere, apparently.
Right.
So who knows?
So let's talk about Khashoggi. We wanted to talk about Jamal Khashoggi. And Caroline, you're a journalist, so I just... Why is this murder important to journalism? I mean, it's sort of amazing that a journalist was murdered by the state of Saudi Arabia, and Trump is like sort of, you know, trying to cover it up with them, it seems. I mean, it's pretty horrifying.
It's just so deeply not surprising, though, which is so upsetting. I mean, the murder itself, like kind of the politics of that aside, and, you know, MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and the reasons for him wanting to target this specific journalist who at one point was actually a much more favorable sort of, I guess, viewpoint on the kingdom and then became a lot more critical in recent years. You know, like that aside... There, in the same way that there have been dog whistles about so many other things from this administration, like Trump's siding with Saudi Arabia and that sort of American faux protectionist, like America first rhetoric and policy. Like, he's been shitting on journalists before he even came to even be a potential candidate, you know, like when he was one of the 33 or how many white men were on stage for the Republican primaries, like when he was just in a sea of wonderful white men, like he was shitting on journalists then, and he's kind of been taking the piss out of them for years, right? Like phoning up the New York Post and pretending to be his own publicist, like just like, remember those things? Those little tidbits.
So cute.
It was so adorable. Yeah. Adorbs.
He went on stage the other day and like commended Greg Gianforte for body tackling that
Ben Jacobs from The Guardian. Yeah, exactly. So it's totally in his DNA to do this. So I don't think anyone in any newsroom anywhere, unfortunately, is like looking at what he's saying now and thinking, dang, we lost the U.S. president. Like,
but it seems like conservatives are saying that there's going to be a price to pay for Saudi Arabia. Do you think that's true? I mean, do you, like the Lindsey Graham types are saying that, you know, if this is proven or whatever, that they're actually going
to
do something.
I mean, just, you know, show me when. Like, I mean, there's been a price to pay for everything that this president has said or done, or like everything that, you know, the president has kind of, obviously the president wasn't responsible for this murder, but like, you know, the Saudi relationship has been something that the United States has excused for years, you know, like, and, you know, obviously Modresi Tehrani, you can tell I'm like, I'm half Iranian, but it's not to say that the, you know, Iranian regime is any better or worse than the Saudi one, but certainly there's definitely been an inherent double standard with the way that we view one extremely hostile bad actor kingdom than the other. So we've been excusing Saudi Arabia for years and years in the same way that we excuse other states when it sort of serves our nature. I don't know. Like, on that issue, I'm, like, a lot less hopeful. But
also, this was over, like, the reason they're hesitant to, you know, like, speak ill of the government is because there's an $110 billion arms deal. And I'm just sort of like, whoa. So this government kills people on the fly, and we're worried about giving them so many, like, this.
And we're saying that out loud,
we're
too.
Saying that out loud. And I'm just like, maybe we shouldn't be giving these people $110 billion worth of arms.
But then he's doubling down. Like, the reason then people in the heartland aren't thinking, well, that's a bit shady, is because the administration hides behind this idea of job creation and like American first politics. Like, okay, yeah, he was some journalist. He wasn't an American. Like, he wasn't, you know, forget the fact that he was actually a permanent resident. So folks like me who have green cards were like, oh, cool, okay, so we can just be like,
no big
droned
deal.
And
bone sawed.
It's gonna be fine. Bone saw, yeah, casual bone saws. It's totally fine.
I feel like if I saw Trump shoot a gun, I would be like, oh, he's not that scary. Like, I feel like he'd be terrible at it and, like, just stupid and bad, and it would make it feel a little less, like,
But what if he did it powerful. In that tennis outfit from that one photo?
I don't know.
I love that photo.
Is tennis, can you describe it for me?
I can describe that photo.
Do you want a backbeat?
He's got a white shirt on. He's got white shorts on. And
tighty whiteys that are showing through the shorts.
You see a little bit of those tighty whiteys.
Well, I was actually thinking about this during the Kavanaugh hearings when all of... you know, after Jeff Flake was approached by those women in the elevator, and it was an effective, like, powerful moment. And then I think it was, like, Orrin Hatch or somebody afterwards was getting an elevator. Women were following him, and his bodyguards, like, blocked the women.
Yeah.
And he was like, na 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 na. And I was just like, waving. Oh, these men aren't, like, confident, good, strong men. They're just rich men who have endless security. They're not like brave or powerful. And they have security against women, like constituents pleading with them. And it's just that to me is what's like when you're saying, can you imagine Trump shooting a gun? I'm like, no, because like he literally has Secret Service plus personal security plus the thugs that have been protecting him his whole life. And it's just like they're not brave men. They're just rich and protected.
Do you think you should yell at Mitch McConnell if you see him in person?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait. This idea of, like, we've got to protect these, you know, people. It's like, we're paying you. Like, I mean, there should be no protection for somebody who is a public servant. Like,
you're trying to take away civil rights. Why do they deserve any civility or courtesy in that regard?
So you guys are part of the mob. You're part of the Democratic mob.
I'm trying to do more push-ups at night to, like, be strong for the liberal militia. It has to happen.
It's true. We saw her do it.
I am not physically that strong, but I'm trying. I do think
you
of
play
it
a professional wrestler on television.
Yeah, I can muster it. I can muster it when I have to. And I was gonna say something a little off topic, but in terms of like you were saying, like, well, which extremism will we, like, allow? Or, you know, is one comparing them one better than the other? I feel like made me think of, I play a terrorist on television, and it made me think of, like, I get a lot of, like, aw, because I also play a wrestler, and it's, like, it's funny because I'm not strong. So I feel like adding it all up, I'm just sort of making terrorism adorable. And I maybe that's a solution, like to empathize with something so radical or radicalized, because it's like our entry points are like media and you know, TV and film, and it's just crossed my mind that, like, first it was a big red flag, like, stop, you can't be this person who's making terrorism adorable. But then now I'm realizing in the spotlight, maybe it's a good thing. I don't know.
No, but there's something to that in the sense of, like, there's this wave of books out right now, right? Like, Rebecca Traister has a book out. Sarai Chamali has one all about female rage and, like, harnessing rage, essentially.
Yeah,
and, like,
I'm also so angry.
Everyone is angry, right? Yeah. Like, we're all, I think that especially with, you know, women, like, and Charlie, I know you're angry too.
I am.
He's just hiding it. But you know, there is this kind of sense right now of, for so long, being pissed off and being really sort of vocal about it was looked down upon, or, you know, you were supposed to be civil. And I actually think that we're at this moment, which is kind of fortunate, where you can be fucking angry and you are allowed to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And actually, no, you're not allowed to hide behind your Secret Service or your, you know, bodyguards when a constituent is saying to you, actually, I was sexually assaulted. Can I talk to you about it? And they say, nah, 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 nah. I mean, like, that's bloody bananas.
Yeah. I think, like, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but my Twitter drafts folder could get me arrested at this point. Like, during the Kavanaugh trial, I mean, it's like when you write a letter that you're never going to send to somebody. I did that for a lot of politicians via tweets and then deleted them. I'm like, okay, I just needed to, like, get it out. Because it is this moment for women where it's just like, it's like they're rubbing it in our face. They control all the branches of, you know, government. And they're rubbing in our face and laughing at us. And, like, the idea, even in that interview, the 60 Minutes interview, Trump was basically just like, she was like, you were mocking Dr. Ford at your rally. And he goes, who cares? We won. And just, like, even that answer, I'm just like, I cry blood. Like, it's like, just one day, it's like they're testing women to snap. I mean, I can't.
Well, I hope everybody snaps in 15 days. You know?
Yeah.
I
amen. Mean, amen.
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to talk about Kavanaugh just a little bit more, like, the whole Republican talking point of, like, I believe her, she was very credible, I believe that she was definitely sexually assaulted by someone. Like, they just got away with that. Like, everybody just kind of ended up saying, like, yep, that sounds right to me.
Because
than, like, the guy who obviously was a blackout drunk did it and forgot about it because it wasn't important to him and because he was blackout drunk, like, you know. That's the way more likely scenario.
They had to figure out a way to make both of the people in the situation victims so they didn't come off morally reprehensible.
And
we let them get away with it.
Well, it was the way that they were playing that respectability politics, right? Like, that's how they did it. They were able to, on the one hand, say, you know, like, I could, you know, she was so credible, absolutely, you could totally believe her. And then on the other hand, they were able to say, like, but Kavanaugh could be like my brother. Or Kavanaugh could be, like, he could be one of your sons. Like, that was, it's the fear-mongering, just in the same way that they do the fear-mongering with the caravan. Like, it could be ISIS, it could be the Taliban, like, you know, the fear. It's just all this, you know, sort of echoes of McCarthyism.
It's staggering and shocking that we're more afraid of our boys being falsely accused than our daughters being sexually assaulted.
And that was Brock Turner, that whole case was, right, like, you know, all about, like, for 20 minutes of fun. Like, don't take away this guy's life. Like, but the judge agreed.
And that more, like, there were only, like, a handful of Republicans who were, like, on the fence about it. Like, it is staggering that most of, like, the Republican side was, like, well, this man is being dragged through the mud, his reputation, it is.
And also, all they had to do was just move on to the next person on the Federalist Society list.
But it wasn't about that. It was about them getting the win. And I don't know. They have, like, created before the midterms this, like, Optimus Prime of fear for their constituents. Like, it's the caravan. It's, like, how white men are getting treated. It's, you know, well, what they're doing with healthcare is insane. I don't know if that's on your list, but just
that they're starting to act like they're pretending
pre-existing conditions is what they've been for all along. It's, like, insane to me. But, and just, I don't know. It is just really I don't know, I'm fatigued and sad. Yeah. And
I mean, everyone is such a larger than life evil person to me. And I mean, it does make me think of wrestling a lot, just how it's like the
it's personas. Cartoonish. And they're so evil that it's really cartoonish.
And it's good and evil, and it's, you know, winning and losing. And it's like, I like revenge dream way too much about like actually confronting someone like Mitch McConnell or Donald Trump and being like, let's fight then, like, and just like get it out of the way, because no, everyone's so, they're all so sad and insecure too. Like, it's so obvious. I hate everyone. Sorry.
No, it's very wrestling heel. Like, yeah. like a poorly written WWE script would be, you know, a wrestler just changing his mind on a dime and like changing his, just like Trump doing the Ted Cruz rally.
Yeah.
Is amazing. And just literally just like, you know, also, for some reason, apparently Trump only talks to the media in front of a helicopter with the blades going now. I don't know if anybody's noticed this.
Presidential.
I used to think it was because he wanted to have, like, an excuse that he couldn't hear the questions or not answer what he wanted to answer. But that's not the case, because he does pretty much answer all the questions. I think they just think it's, like, a position of strength. Like, somebody's decided he seems important if he's, like, about to get on a helicopter, which I guess every day.
Don't those seem like Monty Python comedy bumpers? Just, like, quick 15 seconds as a man's walking into a chopper, someone asks him a question, he says the most batshit thing you can ever imagine, and then he gets on, then he waves happily like he nailed it, and he gets on the chopper and flies away. Like, every single one of those is just like a comedy bumper to me.
And today's episode of the chopper skit was, he used to be Lion Ted, but now I call him Beautiful Ted. Actually, I call him Texas Ted.
I wrote so many jokes about that today. I was like, oh, he self-corrected after he heard him say Beautiful Ted. He goes, oh, no. He's like, he's Texas Ted. I call him Texas Ted.
Beautiful Ted.
Personally, like, beautiful,
he was so excited. It was the first time he'd ever been called beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful is the last thing that Ted Cruz will ever be called. He's a, you know, you could say something nice about him, but he's not a beautiful man.
He has a nicer ring than Zodiac Ted.
Oh, did you guys see that picture from Trump and Melania greeting Ted Cruz at the rally, and Ted was shaking his hand, and this was his posturing. Like, I am at my lowest.
She's showing Ted Cruz's head to the ground. Well, he called his wife a dog, and he retweeted an image about how his wife was ugly and Trump's wife was hot.
But, like, you have to have perspective about, like, you're like, oh, poor Heidi Cruz. And then Heidi Cruz's interview, and she's like, I work for Goldman Sachs, and I'm, like, annoyed we don't have a second house. And you're just like, right, all these people are bad. I need to, like, recalibrate. Like, who am I defending here?
It makes you, this is the problem, is that it makes people sort of lurch towards other, you know, batshit crazy people and be like, oh, they're not so bad, though. They're, like, kind of nice. Like, they're, like, a little adorable.
Like when Alex Jones confronted Marco Rubio in the hallways, and you're like, oh, he's owning, wait, who am I rooting for?
Exactly. You know there's something bad when you're like, I went and bought a Marco Rubio sticker for my car.
So sad. He's so pathetic.
You brought up the Heidi Cruz interview, and I one thing I did want to talk about today is we learned some new information about Ted Cruz. Whenever Heidi Cruz talks to the press, we learn something new. Things like when they got married, he bought like 500 Campbell soup cans and put them in their pantry. I guess because he was worried about his wife cooking. I don't know. Also the time that she went missing for a while and was crying on the side of the road in a ditch. But the new thing that we learned about their relationship is that at their wedding, Ted Cruz insisted upon A Whole New World from the original motion soundtrack to Aladdin being played. Heidi protested and said, but we have a live band. Maybe we could ask them to cover it. And Ted said, no. It cannot be played better than the original from the movie Aladdin, so we must play A Whole New World from the film Aladdin.
She signed her deal with the devil when she signed that marriage contract, let's be honest.
I also like to think that betrays Cruz's, like, immigration tendencies. Like,
that's true.
You know, Beautiful Ted, secretly for the immigrants.
I didn't know I'd have anything in common with Ted Cruz.
Also an Aladdin fan?
But now I do. It must be the original recording from Aladdin. Wow, me too, Ted.
More happy news here. The Trump administration is looking to define gender as fixed at birth, which is just disgusting. Trump, I think, in one of the like helicopter shouting matches today, a journalist like shouted, I thought you were going to be good for the LGBT community. And he just responded, I am. I'm great. I don't know. I mean, this is awful. Do you think that, are they actually going to do this? Is this something that's going to excite their base? Are there, because, I mean, this is happening 2 weeks before the election. Are there Republicans who are just going to race to the polls to have gender fixed at birth?
Racing to the polls is one thing. I think that the notion of exciting the base, like, it does hit points for the base. It does hit points for evangelicals who were, you know, very, very concerned that social progress was going far too quickly, that these ideas of these quote-unquote norms that they had long subscribed to and identified with for so long had been kind of changing. They blame Obama for that. Like, I think that, unfortunately, it is going to have a resonance with a lot of the base. And you know, it comes from, again, kind of unfortunately, I say this with a kind of deep caveat, a not as batshit crazy element of Republicanism. If you think about, you know, the current president as sort of on the far end of that scale, like the people that have been pushing for these kind of very heteronormative anti-trans views have been people who have been working in the Heritage Foundation and this, again, respectability, politics, conservative circles for such a long time. Like the guy pushing for this transgender kind of reversal, I guess, a guy called Roger Severino, he worked for like the DeVos Institute within the Heritage Foundation. So, you know, like this stuff comes full circle. Like these aren't whims. This didn't just come out of nowhere. These have been deeply developed policies, which again is somebody, you know, kind of when you're trying to cover the Trump administration, it can be very disorientating. Because on the one hand, you have him in his tidy whities outside of a freaking helicopter being like, I'm great, beautiful Ted. And you're like, whoa, what's happening over there? And on the other hand, this is again, and we talked about this, I think, last time, which is, you got to just keep the eye on the prize, which is what are they actually developing while the president is saying some relatively inflammatory things? And the answer is they're developing things like, let's try and quote-unquote course correct the transgender issue, is how they put
it. Well, also, they were saying that, like, Trump tends to test ideas on Twitter a lot, like with the transgender ban in the military. He'll just, like, drop the idea on Twitter to get, like, a temperature check. And, of course, it gets people up in arms.
He's like Frank Luntz on
Twitter. Yeah. But I feel like this is almost like, I think there was maybe like a poll came out that evangelical voters were cooling to him. And I think like every once in a while, they just have to like kick Pence a win. Pence is like, I'm still here. Can I like get a policy win here? And I think like they probably had the Heritage Foundation draw up some, you know, because basically these like conservative organizations write policy law bills for them and then just deliver it to their office because nobody in the White House is going to write policy. So they just deliver them like verbiage and is like, what do you guys think about this? And then it like gets out through Maggie Haberman or something like that with the New York Times, and then like the world reacts and they can sort of test if it's not polling well, but like they're trying to sort of like flirt with evangelical voters before the midterms again, being like, hey, this is a reason for you, specific person with like very specific hate in your heart.
And also like, yeah, just like bullying tendencies again or something. It just feels like a call to just like literally punch someone in the face on the streets. Like it feels like I'm trying to push you to fight and like it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen. It's like, I mean, the marginalized people being so angry over and over and over, but it feels like, yeah, we're all gonna pop and it's gonna happen like on the streets.
We're all gonna be on the FBI watch list after this podcast.
You me know. Yeah, that disco ball. Talk into it. Let them know we're here.
I just think it's disgusting that the way to like you know, excite somebody to get out and vote is to take away someone else's rights. I mean, how disgusting is that? That's what the evangelicals want, is to you know, take away somebody else's dignity.
There's this amazing quote I was reading today, Masha Gessen in the New Yorker, and she had this like beautiful line, which is just so sad, but like encapsulates everything we've all been talking about, which is essentially like, we got people who were in, you know, who were transgender, who were non, you know, gender binary, in a position where they felt comfortable to leave the closet, and there is no closet left for them to go back into now.
Yeah,
you know, like
right,
once
exactly.
You were there and you've out, there isn't a closet left. You know, like what do they expect people to be feeling at this point, other than fear and violence?
Yeah, exactly.
Also, just like what. Like, for the party, I mean, obviously, that's not who they are anymore, but they used to be the party of small government, and yet, like, someone tweeted today, it made me laugh, they're like, these people care so much about your genitals, like women's reproductive rights, trans people, gay people, just like they care so much about stuff that does not affect them at all.
About passing governmental laws about
this literally does not affect your, you know, cisgender straight marriage. This has nothing to do with your kids. Like, what are these people are so filled with fear and hate. I feel sorry for them. Like, to have just go through life with that much hate and fear is just like, it's terrifying and it's sad. And I think part of the whole, like, beyond Trump and his administration, I think that the thing that's been the biggest wake-up call to me that's just heartbreaking is just how many people in this country are that hateful. And they continue to support him and they continue, like, just on the, I don't know if it's the culture of social media and how we interact now, but just the idea that, like, it's about winning and owning people. Even if people's lives are at risk, people are getting, like, murdered with hate crimes and, like, Nazis feel safe on the streets. And it's just like, why do they care? Like, why is their policy all about regulating people's bodies and marriages? Like, that's just so, that's deeply sad and fucked to me.
Well, as long as we can have sex with horse-faced porn stars, you know, everything will be okay, right? All right.
Right.
So
that's great segue.
That's so we're going to change gears here a little bit and talk about something that is maybe equally depressing, but in a little bit different way. We're very excited to have Gridlock Sam here. He's the man that coined the term gridlock. He's a transportation and traffic expert, and we're thrilled to have him here. Please welcome Sam Schwartz.
Yes, Sam.
So, Sam, we talk about transit and transportation on this podcast a lot. Cody and I are both cyclists. Manhattan residents and are constantly frustrated with our bike lanes. We're all frustrated with our subway system. And I want to talk to you about what some solutions are to our congestion problems. And the obvious solution, which we have talked about in the show a lot, is congestion pricing, which we were hopeful was going to pass last year, and it didn't pass. So can you explain to everybody what congestion pricing is and let us know if we're actually going to get it?
Sure. Before I get to that, I want to deal with something that has to do with the discussion over here. You were mentioning bike lanes and clearing parked cars from bike lanes, and the fact is the city's doing a terrible job on traffic enforcement. Many years ago, I was in charge of traffic enforcement, and something that may make you feel a little good right now is that there was a car that was constantly parked at 56th Street and 5th Avenue. And I had a no-standing sign, but somebody in that building kept raising the no standing, kept removing the no standing sign. So I had my crews ultimately mount it about 20 feet high so nobody could take it down. And when that person was being waited for with a driver, the driver would not leave, and we arrested the driver. So a little bit of good news over
That's
there.
That's Trump's building. This is a true patriot.
So you arrested Trump's chauffeur.
We did.
Wow, unbelievable.
In terms of congestion pricing, it's an idea that's been around since the 1950s. William Vickery, who went on from a Columbia University professor, went on to win the Nobel Prize, conceived it. London stole it.
What?
And took it from us.
You stole it.
London's been, when did they do it?
2003, London.
Right, and it's working, right?
And we've been trying. I've been at it for 44 years or something like that now. 2019 is our year. We're going to get it.
And congestion pricing, for those that don't know, is charging cars a toll to come into the central business district during rush hour during the day.
Yeah, it's a charge to come in, but also we're looking at charging people who are within the area as well, and charging for hire vehicles, meaning the Ubers, the Lyfts, the Vias, the others, a little bit more, because the speeds in Midtown Manhattan have plummeted from, they were very fast when I was commissioner, 7.5 miles an hour. You know, we had radar guns out to see that they didn't go over 8.
And what are they now?
And now they're 4.7 miles an hour. We walk faster than that, so we need some relief. And anybody that rides the subways knows it's been going downhill for the last 3 or 4 years.
And why is that? Is it de Blasio's fault or is it Cuomo's fault? Or are you not allowed to say that?
You know what? I'll play safe. It's Pataki's fault.
Is it?
About 10 years ago, when Cuomo had this thing about the genius prize for how to fix the subway, I thought of writing something in just to preventive maintenance. It's that simple when you maintain infrastructure. I maintain all the bridges of the city, use the roads, the tunnels, and the city. Preventive maintenance saves a ton of money. Pataki cut back on preventive maintenance. Cuomo didn't pick up on it for a number of years, and now we're suffering the price of that, and we have to pay 10 times as much as if we had done the job right.
So do you think the MTA is in the right direction? There's a new guy in charge of the MTA, Andy Byford. Or do you think his fast-track plan, I think it is, are we going in the right direction other than the fact that we need a lot more money?
Yeah, this is the first time we have a plan. One of the problems with congestion pricing in the past is we didn't have a plan. We knew we needed money. Andy Byford's come, another Brit, has come up with a... has come up with a really good plan. It's at least $40 billion, which may sound impossible. But if we can raise $1 billion from congestion pricing, there's about a 15-to-1 ratio if you bond the money. We can get about $15 billion. We're still looking for the other $25 billion. Maybe we'll have a collection plate later.
So to be clear, the money from congestion pricing that we'd be charging private cars or for-hire vehicles coming to the city would go towards the capital plan at the MTA.
Exactly. So we have to raise tens and tens of billions of dollars.
Another question that I think might be on minds of a lot of people, a lot of New Yorkers, people at this show maybe, is the L train. The L train is going to be shutting down in the spring. Is the city ready for it? I know that I think they've already opened the bike lanes on 12th Street and 13th Street, and I saw that there's just nothing but, like, cars parked in them. And the most infuriating thing that's interesting that used to be in charge of traffic enforcement is the number one offender, like, if I bike in bike lanes every day, and the most likely person to be parked in a bike lane is a cop.
Right. And in those days, the traffic police was separate from the police department. So
they would ticket each other.
So we ticketed them. They arrested a few of my people. I was threatened. The first time I met Rudy Giuliani was towing a few of his vehicles away. I sweated that one out. But somebody's going to get tough out there. It's not as hard as people think. You tow a few cars, and one of the secrets to dealing with the police is if you protect the bosses, they don't care about the people that work for them. You could tow all the cops' vehicles out there.
What a great system. Yeah, sounds like it's working.
Democracy.
So you got to tow important people.
Yeah, you have to make a statement. Probably the best attended session of the United Nations is when I started to tow away diplomats' vehicles. And everybody was there, and they were unified. The whole world was together on one issue.
They were all unified on being mad at you?
They were mad at me. I mean, I was at one table, and there was the entire world out there.
Literally the world, yeah.
Literally, and I was being translated into a dozen languages. And for a moment, I savored the moment because I looked and I saw that there was like a group going by that couldn't hear what was going on. And people in the group were probably looking at the entire world, looking at this one guy and figuring out he must have the answer to world peace. You
know? What was being translated? Was it like there's a black town car with its hazards on?
Yeah. And our State Department was really pissed at me. And they took away our diplomat spaces in other countries.
Well, there are people like diplomats who have these placards, right? I mean, I live in Hell's Kitchen near a police precinct, and my block is technically no parking for anyone, but it's filled with cars on both sides of the street every day, and they all have placards or little business cards that say they're friends with a police officer. And this placard literally just gives you carte blanche to park wherever you want to park, right?
No, it's phony placards, first of all. It's
wow,
the easiest thing
can print
to
one.
Crack down. Anybody can print one,
on
and
the
they
internet.
Are. They're saying, you know, friends of the police department, or they get a copy of a shield. And it's the easiest thing to protect against now, especially with the kind of technology we have, that it should only be legitimate permits. No one is cracking down under the de Blasio administration. I think we're up to over 200,000 placards, and there are only 300,000 employees, so I wonder about those 100,000 that didn't get placards.
Wow. And what is your opinion on parking in general? Because I would like there to be no free parking in Manhattan, personally. It's, you know,
whoa,
the amount of money that we pay to have our apartments, like the amount of money that rent costs, that real estate costs, and that we're giving away free real estate on the street. But if you took all that away, if you just didn't have cars on both sides of every street or one side of every street, and you could extend the sidewalk, you could build a bike lane. There's blocks in Hell's Kitchen where there'll be a stoop and a tree, and my stroller literally can't fit through the sidewalk. So I have to go out into the road, through the parked cars, into the road, and then back. So I noticed that recently parking rates went up by like 50 cents or whatever, but it was like the first time in forever they had been raised. You know, are you sympathetic to people that own a car in Manhattan and want to park for free?
No, not at all. And if you want to park, you should pay. Somebody actually wrote an 800-page tome on the free cost of parking, a fellow named Donald Chupe, professor at UCLA. We should be paying more if you park on street than if you pay in a garage. And at garages, if you're in Midtown, just a few blocks east of where you are, we're hitting triple-digit parking rates. No. And that's every single day.
You mean over $100
a day? Over $100.
No.
Right. Yet you can park for free on the street.
Center and you're parking for free. And you should be paying premium rates. In fact, all those people with the placards, I want to report them to the IRS because they're getting at least $10,000 in benefits every year.
Wow.
I have to say, I lived in L.A. for 8 years, and I'm back in New York now, and like, it is insane to me that you would own a car in New York with all of the transportation options available to you and how much private cars just get to dominate the streets still. Like, I can't believe congestion pricing hasn't passed yet.
And it's a vicious cycle, too, because we're not spending... We don't have congestion pricing, so we're not fixing the MTA. So the MTA gets worse, and people take more Ubers, or they consider owning a private vehicle. And Sam, what's your opinion on for-hire vehicles, on Uber and Lyft? Because it's a staggering... You know the statistics better than me, but the number of for-hire vehicles on the road has ballooned.
Yeah, it's over 100,000, and there are 13,000 taxis, just to give you... a little bit of magnitude over there. When the for-hire vehicles came in, they promised to take people in Brooklyn that last mile to the subway, the same thing in Queens, the same thing in the Bronx. Instead, they congregate among the hottest parts of Manhattan and Brooklyn and Queens, the waterfront areas, the areas that are already the best served by transit, the areas that have our wealthiest citizens, and the areas that have the worst congestion already. So it's been a triple whammy. Good thing I'm not traffic commissioner. I would have pulled the hair out of my beard already.
But then it becomes hard, right? Just in thinking about, like, so I live in Queens, in Astoria. Big up, Queens. And, you know, one of the things that I find difficult sometimes is that, like, you know, if the subways are fucked, which often they can be, like, you know, I'm looking at, okay, I can wait for an hour and a half and I'll maybe get to where I want to go on the subway, or I can take a 20-minute Uber and it'll get me from Queens to, like, you know, South Williamsburg, where my office used to be. But, I mean, and then it gets to this kind of question, which is, like, the subway question, right? Like, the Uber question, the only reason I'm reliant on Uber or Lyft is because the subways are so screwed. So, like, and this kind of gets back to what Charlie was saying, like, who is to blame? Is it Cuomo or is it de Blasio? Because, like, which one of them isn't releasing the money? Like, there was that amazing Times expose all about, like, how, you know, shitty the subways are at the moment and why. And it just sounds like both of them are kind of playing some weird Wild Wild West, Clint Eastwood, like, chicken, where they're just, like, looking at each other with, like, a, I don't know, a toothpick. And
they don't admit who's in charge, right?
Yeah, well, either that or they don't want to own up to who's in charge, or I don't know.
And then it's like, it is important to blame them instead of, like, the Uber driver.
Totally.
If you're, like, moving here to, like, make money because you can and you know how to and send money back to your family and you can, don't blame him.
Totally.
Don't blame him. I don't know.
Except the Uber driver is causing the people who own taxi medallions to kill themselves, too.
I feel like one thing I will say, the people who are not taking responsibility is the multi-billion-dollar corporation Uber. They should offer a better, like, percentage rate to the drivers who hang out in Queens. And,
yeah,
like, instead of punishing the people who take the rides,
yeah,
Uber should transfer a better percentage rate of what they can take home if they go to the outer boroughs. This should be a conversation between the private business and, I mean, I agree with congestion pricing.
Yeah.
I live around the corner from Charlie, and it is like you can walk faster. It's mind-boggling how slow the...
Yeah.
So when you're worried about the Uber drivers, which you should be, all the drivers there, the average income is about $13 an hour. There's been too many drivers, and Uber hasn't made any money. They lose $1 billion a quarter or $1 billion a year. But you have to understand the long-term plan that they have. The long-term plan is to convert every one of their vehicles to autonomous vehicles and fire all the drivers. And so the drivers' jobs only have another lifespan of a few years. By the way, my book is coming out in November.
Sam
no
has
one
a
at the
book.
Wheel, of, yeah. Trying to sell that.
No One at the Wheel, a book about driverless cars.
Yes.
So are driverless cars going to save us, or is it just going to put... Because I'm skeptical. I don't want more cars on the road. I want less cars on the road. Is that going to help congestion? Is it going to help us all?
When I first started working on the book, I called it Driverless Cars, the Good, the Bad, the Ugly. There are, you know, three scenarios and shades of it. The ugly is what we did 100 years ago with the automobile. In 1900, we were walking in every which direction we wanted, and the automobile came on the scene, and it started to kill people. And the people were rising up against the automobile, and they lost. They wanted to control the automobile. By 1930, we were relegated as pedestrians to sidewalk. It was criminalized if we wanted to cross the street wherever we wanted to. The same thing's going to happen with autonomous vehicles. They work great without people. If you put a pedestrian out there, they don't know what a pedestrian is. In Tempe, Arizona, it was an Uber Volvo that hit a woman who not only was a person, but she had a bike with her, and it couldn't recognize it. There are three Teslas have now crashed into fire trucks this year. So, you know, ultimately, they will be safer, but we're in a lot of trouble when they take over and they realize that the pedestrians are getting in their way. And what are they going to do to us? They're going to fence us in. And then at the corners, there'll be cattle gates that we could race across because we interrupt the cars. And there are people that are coming up with plans that want pedestrians to wear some kind of tag that says, I'm a pedestrian and I'm responsible.
Oh, my God.
And if you don't leave with that, you're going to be...
Wait, what's going to stop pedestrians from just attacking driverless cars? Because I would just... I mean, if the streets of Midtown just became driverless cars, I would walk around with a baseball bat and just do some damage.
Allison has so much rage.
I have so much rage, and if there's not a human behind the wheel, that to me is an opportunity.
So, Sam, that sounds like the ugly. What's the good? I mean...
Yeah, the good is if so many people with disabilities right now cannot get driver's licenses. Suddenly they get driver's licenses. My dog can't get a driver's license. My dog will be able to get a driver's license with autonomous
meaning
vehicles.
You could send your dog to the vet right. Without having to go to the vet.
You could do that.
Your kids could get picked up from school.
That's one of the good things. The good is if it finally solves what we call in transportation the last mile or the first mile. The people that live in low-density areas, and this is what Uber and Lyft promised us, and we take people to the trunk lines, the main lines that come in. We protect good transit systems, and we create, in so many places in the United States, we have lousy transit systems. We can replace them with microtransit that's autonomous, and it'll be far better than what we see today. The good is you will not have parked vehicles. The good is 50 to 90% of cars won't be personally owned.
You don't need a private car.
Need a private car. In the street over here, West 3rd or Avenue A, the sidewalks could be widened. All these sidewalks, by the way, were narrowed for the car. They weren't this way 100 years ago. If we went back in time and we were on Park Avenue right now, you'd see this beautiful park right in the middle of Park Avenue with a serpentine path and benches and just two little carriageways on either side. So I'd like to see the good is reversing that trend, returning Park Avenue to a park, returning wider sidewalks, greening the area, encouraging bike and active transportation.
Is Elon Musk going to save us? Is he going to build tunnels underground and get people from city to city really fast?
Okay, so a couple of writers here would appreciate this. Elon Musk talking to a group of writers about 2 or 3 years ago, and they were questioning him, and they were saying, you know, about some of the risks inherent with autonomous vehicles, and he labeled them as murderers. So, you know, Elon Musk is a bit out of touch with what is happening, if you haven't
figured that out.
He labeled
the people that were asking questions murderers?
Reporters. He labeled them as murderers because they're slowing down the advance of autonomous vehicles. At the same time, a year later, he says artificial intelligence is the most dangerous thing, more dangerous than North Korea. And what do you think is going to be in these vehicles? It'll be artificial intelligence. It's almost 1 year ago, next week, that we had a terrorist drive on the bike lane on the West Side Highway, killing 8 people, hitting another 13 people, injuring them seriously. Now, that was a person in a car. Imagine if a terrorist, thousands of miles away, gets control of 10 cars and does it at once. That's why we've got to be careful. There's a lot of ugly out there. There's also a lot of good out there. But I don't see any sign. Last week, the Trump administration issued what's called autonomous vehicles 3.0, and essentially it says the private sector, they know what's best. What's good for AVs is good for America.
So we just have to have a profit motive in traffic, and they'll exactly. figure it all out.
Can I ask real quick what your thoughts are on these like bird scooters coming to New York?
Okay, big fight.
These are
some people from my company.
If you don't know what they are, these are electric scooters that it's sort of like a bike share type, dockless bike share, where anybody can just pick up a scooter on the street and rent, pay a couple dollars and drive it a couple miles.
Yeah, so full disclosure, we're talking to Bird right now about studying the safety aspects. A few people have been killed using motorized scooters. Yesterday, I think in Brooklyn, somebody may have been killed in a motorized
scooter. A privately owned motorized scooter.
Yeah, yeah. And in DuPont Circle in D.C. a week ago, somebody was killed in them. How they mix with the cars, but the problem is we assume that the scooters are dangerous. It's not the scooters that are dangerous. It's the cars that are dangerous. And we just have to flip our mindset and go back 100 years and think, how did we give up this right to own the street, walk where we want to walk, walk when we want? You know, 100 years ago, we told people, we're going to shine a light in your face and you have to stop. We shine another light and you go. That's outrageous. What's going to happen to us now?
So there was a picture that was going viral on Twitter where somebody had taken a picture of, I think in like Santa Monica, Bird just dumped a bunch of bikes on the street, didn't really ask for permission. But there was a picture of like, there's like seven Bird scooters kind of in a heap together, because the way they work is anybody can just get off and park wherever you want to park at, anywhere on the sidewalk or anywhere. And, you know, somebody had took that picture and was like, oh, this is disgusting. Look at all the space that these Bird scooters are taking up. And because they were taking up a portion of the sidewalk, but that same picture, there were twice as many parked cars in the same picture. And it's a car blindness is a real thing. And it wasn't there. There's a Safe Streets advocate, you may know, Doug Gordon. He goes by Brooklyn Spoke on Twitter. But we had him on our show a couple years ago, and it just completely opened my eyes. I was already, a cyclist and was somewhat aware of the problem with cars, but it wasn't until really talking to him that I realized how many cars are surrounding me at all times and how much real estate we're giving to cars. And for somebody to be able to take a picture with 12 cars in it and seven scooters and think that scooters are the problem is amazing.
Yeah, exactly, and we see that all the time. Cars are occupying 30 to 40% of many cities. You go to cities and it's parking lot, street after street that's dedicated to automobiles, and you don't see the people. And people forget that's the reason that we have cities, so you can get around. And we've lost mobility, and the 4.7 miles an hour, we have no mobility in cars anymore, which actually that's been a good thing for congestion pricing, because when I go out to elected officials and I talk about it, and I've only been doing this for decades, they all drive to work and they have placards. This, in the past year, traffic has gotten so bad that they're complaining to me, we've got to do something. So,
the worst offenders, yes. Driving by themselves in a private vehicle to
they
park
want to get
illegally
rid of
on the street.
Other cars. They're hoping they get the government.
Well, I also live off a major avenue, and I mean, beyond inconvenience, like ambulances are stuck in traffic with their sirens wailing. And I recorded once on my phone, because I mean, I'll be sitting working on my bed and I'll hear a siren for 2.5 minutes straight stuck on my block. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, is this person dead now? Like, what are the options? Like, the ambulances can't get to hospitals. Like, it's insane to me.
And there's the climate aspect of it, too, right? I mean, just
sure.
All the air that we're breathing.
Yeah, and you know, the very good argument about ambulance and response times. And I work with a couple of doctors, neurologists over at NYU, and I forget the exact number, but if you're a stroke victim, you lose 2 million brain cells a minute. So the 2.5 minutes could have been 5 million brain cells that a person in the back of that ambulance could have lost. So there are real human costs. And then carbon footprint costs, they're going to be incredible. Almost every study of autonomous vehicles says we're going to increase vehicle miles traveled. People will live further away. People will never leave their autonomous vehicle. You've probably seen the film WALL-E, and that is an autonomous chair. Well, Volvo put, I thought it was ridiculous. And I use it in a slide presentation, and I thought, you know, we're never going there. Volvo has a YouTube, which you should check out, in which you sleep in it, you wake up, and you have your breakfast in it.
Just drive around
moving.
All day. This
you
is
know,
amazing.
You then have a meeting in it. Then you have a dinner, and drones arrive and deliver your food and recharge you, and you never leave. So it's Wally is not so far-fetched.
Well, but in terms of emissions and climate change and all that, I think we can all feel a little comforted in the fact that Trump's uncle was a scientist and he has a knack for science. And we found out this week that things are going to be okay.
It's okay, yeah, because it's genetic. When one of your family members is a scientist, it's like osmosis.
Could you imagine if Obama was said that his uncle was a scientist, therefore?
Oh, but he would have been, you know, from like Kenya or not American. So it would have been a different kind of science.
Does everyone in the audience know? I mean, I'm actually curious. Does everyone know how many living siblings Trump still has?
Six.
Four.
Nobody
interviews these siblings. Like, people don't know
and
that.
And they don't speak. They don't show up to rallies.
They're supportive of him. One is, like, a federal judge. One is, like, in real estate. But they don't talk about him. They don't interview him. Like, people do not know that Trump has all these siblings that don't talk about him.
We found out in that massive Times article that nobody read and everybody forgot about that Trump tried to get all of his, like, siblings sort of out of the will at one point. He tried to sort of take over his Fred Trump's estate.
I can't wait till Ivanka does that to him and he really has to reckon with a lot in his brain.
So just to close on congestion pricing, Sam, why? What is the opposition? Why didn't it get done? I mean, we have a mayor here who's in the past has been very skeptical of it. And we talk about ambulances being stuck in traffic. His reason for being skeptical is that people in outer boroughs need to like drive into the city to go to doctor's appointments, as if that's what people do, as if they wouldn't just get on the subway to go to a doctor's appointment. Do you feel like de Blasio is turning a corner? Is Cuomo on board?
Who's to blame?
You say 2019. Not who's to blame, but
they're to blame for the taxi medallion cab owners who killed themselves.
But are we turning a corner? Is everybody getting in line? Is it really going to happen? I mean, I guess really we all need to go out and vote, particularly if you're in Senator Marty Goldman's district in Brooklyn, or if you're in any Republican district, you need to go out and vote in 2 weeks. But you're hopeful for this getting done.
Yeah, Cuomo, he 3 weeks ago at a breakfast for ABNY, Association for Better of New York, had a slideshow that in one of those said the only answer for the subway problem is congestion pricing. Cuomo is 100% on board. Last year he didn't do it, or 2018 he didn't do it, because courage waxes and wanes with election cycles. Right. Next year nobody is being elected. That's why I think 2019 is a good year. The mayor, you know, he's... both of them, by the way, call themselves car guys. Both of them were resistant to congestion pricing. Cuomo is now on board. I'm hoping de Blasio, he's been quiet lately. In the past, he used to say things like, if you're going to a doctor's appointment. Meanwhile, if you go to a doctor's appointment at NYU, it's $40 to park your car.
Right. So these poor people from the outer boroughs are driving their private vehicles and paying tolls and then spending $40 in parking.
Right. And the Community Service Society that represents the lowest income people in the city of New York estimates at least a 38-to-1 ratio, meaning 38 people of low income will benefit any low income person that may be hurt by this.
So here's my final question is, if we have congestion pricing, how much will de Blasio have to pay when he drives his caravan of SUVs from the Upper East Side to Park Slope to run on a treadmill every day?
Okay, he's going to have to pay $11.52 when he goes south of 96th Street. Then when he comes back from Brooklyn, another $11.52. So he's going to have to pay $23.
Okay, well, we'll find out if it's worth $23, a caravan of four SUVs, so he can go run on the treadmill.
That's $100.
Okay, we'll cost him $100. Well, actually, it'll cost all of us $100 for him to do that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thanks, everybody, for coming out tonight. Let's give it up for Sam Schwartz, our expert on transits. Such an honor to have him here. And our wonderful panel, give it up for Sunita Mani, Ali Horde, and Caroline Matarazzi-Tirani. Subscribe to our podcast, listen to future shows, or come right back here. Our next show is November 26th. Cody will be back. Hopefully she survived the Donald Trump Jr. rally. And in the meantime, we've said this has been our show's catchphrase every episode for the 2.5 years we've been doing it, but it's now more important than ever. Don't forget to vote in midterm elections. Have a good night, everybody. Cody and Charlie and a few of their friends chug a couple of beers and talk politics. It's better when you do beer then. This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.